Armenia heads to the polls today in what our next guest says is one of its most pivotal elections since independence in 1991. It's the first parliamentary election since the long-contested territory of Nagorno-Karabakh was definitively taken over by Azerbaijan in 2023 after decades of conflict and 100,000 ethnic Armenians were expelled from the territory. But the prime minister in office when those momentous events occurred, Nikol Pashinyan, is nevertheless riding high in the polls. Amidst pressure from Russia to resist what's often described as Armenia's pivot to the West under Pashinyan. Joining us to discuss the impending election is Lawrence Brewers, co-founder and co-editor-in-chief of the Caucasus Survey and also an associate fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House. Lawrence, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much, Julian.
Now, there are 18 parties running in this election, I understand, but Prime Minister Pashinyan's civil contract does seem to be well ahead. Could you give us your analysis of Pashinyan's time in office and his prospects at this election?
Well, the latest polls indicate that he is on course to win. He has the most solid base in the electorate of all of the contending parties. That base covers around about a third of the electorate. But if we look at data from May polling with regards to undecided voters as to whether they believe Armenia is going in the right direction, we see that a majority of them do believe that Armenia is moving in the right direction. So it's quite a paradoxical situation. In a sense, we have this prime minister, Nikol Pashinyan, who has ruled Armenia through an era of repeated military disasters and calamities. And yet, he is still riding high in the polls, and we are expecting him to win. And this isn't the first time. In June 2021, that is to say, just after an absolutely catastrophic defeat in the Second Karabakh War in 2020, he won with a landslide. So the situation in this election is that we are less than 3 years since Azerbaijan's military operation that incorporated the territory of Mountainous Karabakh. And here we are, he's set to win once again. So I think, you know, one of the challenges is to explain Pashinyan's political survival.
Yes, I think you've just guessed my next question.
Yeah. Despite these calamities, and I think there's a number of things to capture here. First of all, Pashinyan is campaigning on a platform of peace. He has defined his campaign in terms of what he calls real Armenia. This is the slogan, the overarching message of his campaign, that we need to work for the real Armenia that we actually have, rather than the historical Armenia or the augmented Armenia, incorporating Karabakh and other territories that historically were populated by Armenians. And this peace agenda, I think, does resonate with a war-weary population. Armenia has been through around about a decade of consistent violence along various front lines with Azerbaijan. And so there's a kind of a fait accompli to this notion of real Armenia. Added to that and augmenting the plausibility of this real Armenia is the fact that the opposition are in the main associated with the previous regime that ruled up to the 2018 Velvet Revolution that brought Pashinyan to power. They built their careers on the Karabakh movement, and they are advocating for stronger associations with Russia. So in a sense, they are offering a return to dependency on Russia to the electorate. So I think, you know, where Pashinyan's campaign is succeeding is with this peace offer to an electorate that is tired of war. Other factors are that, relatively speaking, Armenia's economy has been doing pretty well recently. Some of these statistics are due to re-exports to Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union, of which Armenia is a part. But the country is a construction site at the moment. The macroeconomic indicators have been doing relatively well. So I think this is another string in Pashinyan's bow. And yeah, the background factor is, of course, that Pashinyan came to power through a civic uprising, a pro-democracy movement in 2018. He still is the face of the Velvet Revolution. And although the reform agenda has been very unevenly implemented, there has been some progress in some areas that were very important to the mass mobilization for democracy in 2018, including the electoral system, including anti-corruption measures. And so I think the electorate has it pretty clear that Pashinyan is the least of all possible evils in this election.
Right. Yeah. Well, he certainly does seem to have performed some sort of political magic to maintain this position. I did want to ask you, though, Lawrence, you referred, of course, to his brave leading of the civic uprising in 2018, the Velvet Revolution in Armenia. At the same time, regardless of their associations, the leader of one of the opposition parties, the Strong Armenia Alliance, is currently under house arrest. That doesn't feel like the sort of thing that would happen under a committed Democrat. What has Pashinyan conducted himself in government according to the principles that he espoused when he was leading the Velvet Revolution?
Well, in a way, that's a very difficult question to answer, in the sense that essentially from summer of 2020, Pashinyan ruled over a country that was at war or surviving the consequences of the devastating defeat. And it's not only that there was, you know, a 6-week very intense conflict with Azerbaijan in 2020, but there was a whole cycle of ongoing escalations and frontline violence from May 2021 right up to September 2023. So these haven't really been normal political conditions. But with that said, I think we do see signs that Nikol Pashinyan's party, the Civil Contract Party, has been morphing into a rather typical ruling party in a hybrid sort of post-Soviet regime. There have been a lot of claims and concerns expressed in this election campaign with regard to this use of administrative resources. So public sector employees being pressured to attend pro-government rallies. There have been the arrests of opposition figures. There have been really concerning, very vitriolic encounters on the campaign trail, where Nikol Pashinyan has been confronted, for example, by Karabakh Armenian refugees, people who came over from mountainous Karabakh following Azerbaijan's military operation in September 2023, who are questioning his peace agenda. And there has been an absolutely, you know, vitriolic response from the minister. And in one case, the person concerned was arrested on charges of hooliganism, which is, you know, really worrying and obviously does not conform to the image of a committed Democrat. So, you know, I think there is this slippage in terms of the Civil Contract Party's standing and reputation. This contrasts with Nikol Pashinyan's rather apolitical messaging style in his online persona. Nikol Pashinyan is a very skilled political communicator, and he has learned how to use online presence, you know, videos on Instagram of him listening to popular music, his role as the drummer in a band, playing concerts. He's kind of mastered this skill of presenting himself as a kind of, you know, an ordinary punter, somebody that you could go for a drink with in the pub. Very smooth, apolitical messaging style is contradicted by this, you know, regression into really aggressive, vicious rhetoric. So that there is slippage, but I think compared to the opposition forces, their alignments with Russia, I mean, some is one case. He's made his money through supermarkets in Russia and in Armenia. The other figures in the opposition, let's not forget, Robert Khochadian, former president of Armenia, is associated with post-electoral violence on 1st of March 2008. That was the worst post-electoral violence in the history of the post-Soviet South Caucasus. 10 people died. So, you know, again, I think it's a question of relative evils. And another critical factor here is that Nikol Pashinyan has been leaning into relationships with Western states and obviously relationships with states that have sort of normative expectations. So I think in Armenian civil society, even if there is concern at some of the developments I've been describing, Nikol Pashinyan is more tractable, is more vulnerable to popular pressure than other candidates in this election. And so I think, you know, we do need to be concerned about whether Armenian democracy can survive. It is now the only, it is the sort of the most democratic state in the South Caucasus. It's very much an anomaly in the region. But again, Pashinyan, I think, is the figure that people have more confidence in with regard to the future trajectory of Armenian democracy than the other candidates in this election.
Lawrence, France 24 is reporting a wide range of Russian measures ahead of the Armenian election, apparently to impose pressure in a whole lot of direct and indirect ways. Could you give us a sense of what Russia is doing before the election and what impact it's having within Armenia?
Sure. I'll come to the impact in a minute, but I think with regard to Russia and with regard to the geopolitics of this election, there is very wide reporting around Armenia's pivot to the West, that Armenia is caught in this sort of binary geopolitical field between Russia and the West, and having been widely perceived as a rather subservient client state to Russia, it is now pivoting to the West. I think this is a kind of a stereotype about this election and about Armenia's foreign policy choices that is rather reductive. The South Caucasus is very much in a multipolar space. Even if Russian-Western competition was a prominent dynamic some years ago, there are many more complex dynamics at play in the region. And so it's rather simplistic to see this as a pivot to the West. The West itself is a complicated concept. We no longer have a unified Western pole in global geopolitics, as we might once have argued did exist. And I think Armenia's foreign policy is responding to this. The key issue with Russia is that the backbone of the relationship historically was security, what I call a rescue fantasy, that Russia would provide security guarantees for Armenia in return for its allegiance. That contract has been broken, in part through the 2020 Karabakh War, but even more seriously, I think, through the subsequent developments. In September 2022, Azerbaijan mounted a large-scale offensive on Armenia itself, not talking about the contested territory in Mountainous Karabakh, and Russia basically did nothing. The Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is the kind of NATO equivalent but led by Russia, also did nothing more than send a fact-finding mission. So that contract has been broken. Perceptions of Russia in Armenia have undergone a very dramatic change. Before 2020, something like 80% of the population saw Russia as a friendly country. That's now down to around about a third. It's now France that's seen as Armenia's best friend internationally. And so there is a recalibration of the relationship. It is moving from security into the economic and a more transactional basis. And here the linkages remain very strong. There remain powerful, really embedded structural dependencies in the field of energy, in the field of food security, in the field of management of key sectors of Armenia's transport infrastructure, for example, the railway. So I think what Nikol Pashinyan is trying to do is to recalibrate, renegotiate the asymmetries in this relationship, to reduce those asymmetries by diversifying foreign policy. And Russia, conversely, is trying to signal that it doesn't want this to happen, hence the various measures reported by France 24, including embargoes on Armenian agricultural produce imported into Russia, threats to raise the energy price, the recalling of the Russian ambassador to Armenia, and a kind of trying to call Armenia's bluff by saying that if Armenia wants to pursue this vector towards membership of the European Union, that's a very distant prospect, but it is something that Armenia has committed to, then it should run a referendum on its membership of the Eurasian Union, which is the economic union that Russia leads. Having said all of this, I think we should also be rather circumspect on the nature of this pivot, in the sense that there are red lines for Russia, and Pashinyan isn't crossing them. At least he's not crossing them yet. So there has been no mention of ejecting the Russian base that still is maintained in the city of Gyumri, The membership, Armenia's membership of the Eurasian Union has not been put on the table in a concrete way by Nikol Pashinyan. So there is a fluidity to this. And I think, you know, everybody in Armenia understands that a successful leader of this country needs to be fluid in managing the different vectors in Armenia's foreign policy and in its external dependencies, rather than making binary choices. You know, a small country in a small, vulnerable country in a fractured geopolitical environment needs to avoid making concrete choices. And I think that is where Armenian foreign policy is headed.
Yes, certainly Prime Minister Pashinyan's public statements ahead of the election on those questions of membership of the various different bodies does seem either conciliatory or at least to embrace the ambiguity and indeterminacy of the current situation. And from what you're saying, that is very much intentional.
We have moved into a different era of geopolitics in the South Caucasus, and one might argue in the world. In the South Caucasus, first years of independence was very much about a vertical geopolitics where Russia, as the former colonial power, was still very much embedded and leveraging security linkages in particular to remain dominant. We then moved into an era of vectoral geopolitics where the European Union and NATO memberships began to be actively discussed. Georgia was very committed to that pathway under President Mikhail Saakashvili. That vector, I think, has exhausted itself. The 2020 Second Karabakh War, I think, put things into perspective that there are other countries that matter, other geopolitical poles that matter in the South Caucasus. And we are now in a much more multipolar environment. And I would describe this as a kind of nodal geopolitics, where the countries of the South Caucasus are leveraging their location to become nodes in wider networks and flows between economies, between regions, and between blocks. And in that sense, I think Armenia is converging on a foreign policy modus that has long been practiced by Azerbaijan. Georgia is also on this same pathway. And so in that sense, I think we will see a lot more strategic ambiguity, compartmentalization, hanging around in the waiting room for accession to a particular block, hanging around in a decompression chamber rather than actually leaving a block. And this is, I think, the geopolitical modus that we are going to see from all three countries in the South Caucasus. And I think this is something that is understood in Armenia. And we need to be, you know, quite circumspect about Armenia's European choice. It is still a member of the Eurasian Union. With Georgia stalling its own accession process, there are real limitations on what can be expected of a European pathway. And the EU itself is preoccupied with Ukrainian, Moldovan accessions, not to mention a host of other issues. So again, it is about leveraging the ambiguity rather than making definitive choices.
One thing that Armenians will not vote on this Sunday is the constitution of the country, but there is a referendum on that question, which relates to Karabakh impending. Could you explain what the situation with the constitution and the referendum is?
Sure. So in the aftermath of Azerbaijan's military incorporation of Mountainous Karabakh in September 2023, Armenia and Azerbaijan progressed with a bilateral process to negotiate a peace agreement. They announced in March 2025 that this negotiation was complete, that they had a text, and this text was then initialed by the foreign ministers at the White House summit with President Donald Trump in August of last year. So we have an agreement, but there are still preconditions before it can be definitively signed.
Yeah, so what's the diplomatic distinction between an initialing and a signing, Lawrence? There's not one I was familiar with.
It's a provisional commitment. But from Azerbaijan's perspective, so this is the Azerbaijani perspective on this, is that Armenia's constitution, the current constitution, has a preamble. And in that preamble, there is indirect reference to late Soviet era documentation that still refers to the unification of Armenia and Mountainous Karabakh. And in Azerbaijan, there is concern that this sort of legal residue from a previous era could in the future provide some kind of legitimation or a loophole for a future Armenian leadership, given that Armenia is a democracy of sorts and permanent leadership is not guaranteed, to somehow revive the territorial claim to mountainous Karabakh. So Azerbaijan is saying that in order for this agreement to be signed by the leaders of the two countries, Armenia needs to change its constitution. So to do that, Armenia needs to run a constitutional referendum. And to table a constitutional referendum, the ruling party in Armenia needs to have a two-thirds majority in the parliament. And so what matters in this election is not only whether Nikol Pashinyan wins, because he is seen as the face of this negotiation, as the face of peace, essentially, with Azerbaijan, but it also matters by what margin he wins in terms of taking this process forward. So this election is a kind of one hurdle, one threshold that needs to be passed in order for the next steps to be taken in the political track to complete the negotiation of the peace agreement. Now, if I don't think it's very likely, but if Pashinyan were to lose, or perhaps in a more likely scenario, more probable scenario, if he wins but with an insufficient majority, then we might see the stalling of the political process. And that's where the logistics track, the connectivity track that has been underwritten by President Trump becomes very important. Part of the agreements of the Washington Declaration from last August were for this Trump route for international peace and prosperity, the TRIP, which is this very important transit route running through southern Armenia, connecting Azerbaijan with its exclave, Nakhchivan, and hopefully in the future, in the not too distant future, connecting through to an opened Armenian-Turkish border. This is the sort of the connectivity track that reestablishes an interconnected South Caucasus. If the political track stalls, then the connectivity track will be needed to continue progress and to avoid a kind of a shutting down of the entire peace process. So in that sense, this election is a kind of an important threshold that takes us into the vestibule, as it were, or a final signature of the peace agreement.
And you mentioned there the border between Armenia and Turkey, which by and large has been closed for more than a century. Is that border opening likely to happen, Lawrence?
Well, in a way, that is the million-dollar question for the South Caucasus, because if that border opens, we're in a whole new ballgame where structural dependencies in key commodities and economic sectors on Russia will just look completely different because there will be this alternative. So yes, the Armenian-Turkish border was very briefly opened for some transit in the early 90s after Turkey recognized the Republic of Armenia. It was closed after April 1993, when Armenian forces took over one of the adjacent regions to mountainous Karabakh as part of the war effort to retain control over Karabakh. The border was closed by Ankara in solidarity with Azerbaijan. And Ankara has made its reopening contingent on the conclusion of the Karabakh conflict. Now, many in Armenia would argue that with the formal renunciation of territorial claims on Azerbaijan, with the formal recognition of Azerbaijan's territorial integrity, then in fact the conflict is over and that Ankara could move forward. But to date, that hasn't happened. Azerbaijan seems to still have a critical veto on this. So while there have been positive steps, there has been a rehabilitation of the infrastructure on either side of that border. There was a momentary opening of the border to facilitate the transition, the transit of Armenian aid when the Turkish earthquake took place some time ago. And there have been commitments to opening the border to third-party diplomatic passport holders. But so far, it has proven elusive. So this is, I think, you know, the game-changing factor that is sort of waiting in the wings. And I think, here it really is down to Baku and Ankara. They have the power to allow this to happen and to, by doing so, really reorient the South Caucasus completely into a more east-west dynamic and to limit its north-south importance, the significance of the north-south vector in the region. So whether it happens, I guess, yes, it's contingent on the progress in the political track. But, you know, I think there are clear interests for Azerbaijan and Turkey to move forward with this.
Well, that is fascinating and really does make this election on Sunday seem like the potential entry to the wings of the vestibule to significant changes that could really transform the region. Lawrence, it's been fascinating discussing the situation with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much, Julian, for the invitation.
That's Lawrence Brewers, the co-founder and co-editor-in-chief of the Caucasus Survey and also associate fellow in the Russian and Eurasian program at Chatham House. And Lawrence is also the author of the book Armenia and Azerbaijan, Anatomy of a Rivalry. That is a 2019 title, and given everything that Lawrence was saying, you might well think that it's due for another edition, and Lawrence tells us that it will indeed have a second edition, which will be coming out soon.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.